Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
So I've just decided we're going to talk about relative motion versus orientation. Bill and I have spent the last 10 minutes trying to figure out what we should talk about.
So that's fine. I'm good with that.
We're just going to talk about that. So
How about this? I think the perspective is that all motion is relative motion.
Sure.
And I don't think that's the case at all. In fact, I think there's very little relative motion that's available.
In cases of injury,
Here's the problem. Okay.
Well, before we get into this, let's talk about what relative motion is versus orientation. Sure. Because this is very Bill-y.
Yeah. Yeah. Hang on a second. Let me grab a knee.
So just for the people at home, we're talking about joint motion. We're talking about relative motion at joints to allow for movement through space.
Yes.
Okay. Versus an orientation where you can take all joints and move them in one direction together as one piece.
Right.
To allow for motion and force production and display to happen.
Right. So this, and that becomes an important point that would be associated. This is why not all motion is relative. And this is why forces get magnified by accident and things like that, because people don't distinguish, right? It's like, okay. So real quick, I'm just going to grab my knee here so you can see this. Okay. So I got a tibia and a femur, right? And so if I go like this, they're moving together. Right. So I've oriented the entire lower extremity into IR here. I've oriented the entire lower extremity into ER in this circumstance. And if I do that, they are now moving relative to one another. So this is straight up Einstein, right? This is relativity applied to joint motion.
Can you show it at the pelvis too? I think people understanding what a pelvis oriented looks like versus a relative motion in pelvis.
So if I don't do anything separate, this is a pelvis that will move somewhat separately. If I take the whole pelvis and I move the whole pelvis, and this is why I'm pretty clear with terminology. I will say anterior orientation of the pelvis, right? Because people misunderstand a nutated sacrum, which is actually a relative motion relative to the ilium, and they will say that's a nutation. And I would say, no, that's an entire pelvis that's moving together, right? Which means that the whole pelvis is orienting as a single unit versus a relative position change of the sacrum, again, relative to the ilium.
Yeah. So, okay.
And we have to be able to distinguish between the two.
Right.
We'll kind of, the behaviors are different.
Right.
By a long shot.
That's going to be important to repeat for the people in the back. So understanding that counternutation and nutation are different of the sacrum are different than an anterior orientation or a posterior orientation or a lateral deviation of a pelvis.
Correct.
Okay. One requires there to be spaces that are created between bones at the point of the joint to allow that relative motion is one piece moving in a different order from the other piece or in sequence.
Yes. So if I bring out my knee again, I'll hold it at this angle. So let's love Einstein, not comparing myself by any stretch of imagination, but let's use an Einsteinian kind of perspective, right? And it's like, so if I am a little man that's this big and I'm standing on the femur right here. Okay. And the femur doesn't move. Okay. The femur doesn't move at all. And I'm looking at the tibia and I see the tibia turn like this. The perception is that I'm stable and then the tibia is moving, right? That would be relative. That means the tibia is moving relative to me. If I'm still this little man standing on the femur and I turn the femur this way, the perception is exactly the same for me, that I am now stable, but the tibia would be moving, even though the tibia is not moving and I am moving relative to the tibia. So that helps you identify this concept of relative motion.
Right.
If I'm doing this, where they are moving in the same direction at the same rate, there's no perceived difference. And if I'm not aware of the fact that we are changing position, it's like me standing on Earth and the Earth is spinning you know, at 17,000 miles per hour or whatever it is. I don't remember the exact, you know, right. speed. It's like, we don't perceive the rotation of the Earth because we are in this fixed, you know, stable position on Earth.
Right. So right. understanding that movement, human movement, biomechanics through space requires there, in order for there to be a distribution of force through the body, energy will move up and down the whole system in a sort of a wave. And that will require there to be a chain reaction of relative motions happening at each segment, up and down, over and over again, at the same time, superimposed on each other.
And what this does is it provides elements of timing.
Yes.
Right. So segments will move again relative to one another, right? And there's advantages here because it allows us to slow things down, speed things up, absorb energy, dampen forces that might be applied that could be destructive or alter the directions that we can actually move. So for instance, if I don't have relative motion at the knee, the energy that's coming from the ground up towards me, which would typically be termed as ground reaction force, which is actually, it has an internal rotation bias to it. It's like, it doesn't move towards the center of me. It moves away from midline. And then I can't access the relative motion of internal rotation that I would typically have if I was landing on the ground. And so now I have to figure out another way to produce the IR. And in those circumstances, this is where I have to start tying things together, because instead of having this effect where I can distribute the energy, I now have a much larger amount of energy that I'll have to try to manage. And so I use compensatory strategies where I have to actually tie things together that will allow a higher force strategy to occur.
Right.
Right. Which could be detrimental to structure.
Yeah. So that when we're talking about relative motions needing to occur for the distribution of force, when we're saying most of the time there's orientation going on, or in many cases there's orientation going on, there will be some type of, if joint segments and groups of joints are moving all at once without letting this progression of this wave going up and then back down, there has to be there. This will create focal points of tension, right?
Or pressure and pressure.
And pressure, which will lead to things that we would typically see in the clinic, which would be a bunion, a knobby medial knee, some type of hip lesion,
a symptom of sorts.
A symptom, which would mean that we have lost some relative motion around that area. There is not a distribution of the forces through that area. Yes. So one spot has become like the weak link in this chain reaction that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And that has led to either some sort of perception of pain or maybe some sort of structural mechanical change over time based on this pressure that is not able to be alleviated through relative motion.
Which would ultimately produce some sort of observable or measurable limitation, which is why we use a chessboard, you know, that has all of our measurements on it that tells us, it's like, where are these areas where we have reduced areas of relative movement? Where do we have these representations of an orientation? So that's what the chessboard does. So the chessboard helps us identify these. It literally creates what I always look at it as like the 3D printer, if you will. It's like literally like prints out the shape of this individual. Like if we do table tests and things like that, it's like this person laying on the table, they're not laying in some imaginary perfect position, nor do they have access to any quantifiable full relative movement necessarily, but it does create this picture. It gives us the shapes that this individual is able to acquire to allow them to move through space. And so we can actually identify where these limitations are. And then we can strategize interventions that allow us to restore the relative motion that would dissipate those forces in the first place. So when we're successful with that, that's why people start to feel better in most cases.
Right. So when Bill says, if anyone's new, if Bill says chessboard, he's talking about like table measures in a physical therapy environment. So
it's an organized, representation of the typically isolated joint measures.
Yeah. So we're talking about joint measures. What we're talking about, like if we were going to take someone and we're going to do like a hip ER, IR measurement, if someone's measuring zero for both, then we can assume that something is structurally wrong with the hip or we've lost relative motion at this area. Yeah. Which means that in order to move, this person has had to kind of lock areas together. The pelvis moves as a brick, and it sort of orients itself.
Yes.
And then this is what you would lead to some type of movement dysfunction or some type of gait dysfunction, or like the Trendelenburg gait, or like
it's not a dysfunction. It is a solution. This is the strategy based on structure, learned behaviors and affordances in the environment that determine what they will do. It's like the minute you start labeling this, it's like, then you're blaming somebody for something. And the reality is it's like, they're just coming up with the best available solution. It's not good. It's not bad. It just is.
It's an exceptional behavior.
We decide that it's bad or not.
It's a behavior that looks different than what we would expect to see given the task.
Yeah. It's like from the average available options, we are making a comparison of each individual towards some theoretical average.
Use
the average to identify where we can determine these limitations. So again, we take literally our chessboard shows us the relationships that say that this is not true hip joint motion. This is a substitution for the hip joint motion. And it tells us where the orientation is occurring. This is what allows you to determine the interventions that you would use to restore relative motion, because that's typically, I will say typically, the goal in like a rehab situation. In most circumstances, we want to maximize the return of relative motion because that gives us the best measure of movement-based health, right? Because when we have relative motions, we can usually manage the forces. We have access to all of our available options, and we become the most adaptable regardless of the environment in question.
Sure. And going back to because gait analysis is something that people are interested in. So we're talking about like typical leaning and listing behavior in gait. It's labeling it dysfunctional is not fair, because it's not like they have a choice. A lot of times the behavior that you're seeing is because this person is trying to accomplish the task of moving forward through space. They've lost this sort of relative motion that we're talking about. Segments are locked together via compression and the movement of the center of gravity away from the midline. And the only option that they have to perform this task is to kind of waddle.
Right.
So what we're...
They have to access a space. They have to push down into the ground. And if I take away movement options, I will still find a way to access a space and push down in the ground.
Sure.
And then that's what you're observing. You're saying this is now the strategy that they are using. But there are consequences to these strategies. And that's where people get caught up in blaming the system for doing something wrong, when the system is literally doing an amazing thing by solving a problem. However, like I said, there's just consequences to that. And those are typically what we would call symptoms, right?
Sure.
If somebody's coming in a rehab situation. In a performance situation, it might be the solution that allows them to throw a baseball 100 miles an hour.
Right, because that's outside of the normal functions of the normal.
We talk about the average person. They're not going to be able to do that, right?
Yeah, because if I want maximum force transmission and production, I'm going to need to lock a bunch of stuff together.
Absolutely. Otherwise, you would be dissipating the energy that you would use for the force production. Right.
It would just kind of fizzle out.
So you can't do that. So you have to tie things together so you can maximize. We want to, like, in high force situations, you will use orientations. It is a given, because you can't produce maximum force in any other circumstance. If you try to do it with relative motion, I got bad news for you. You sprained an ankle, you blew out a knee, you compressed a hip, you blew a spinal disc, you dislocated a shoulder. Like, take your pick. Like, all of these destructive elements are where there is too much relative motion in a high force situation.
Yeah. And the dynamic ways to, we mentioned this before, but dynamic ways to represent this to see this in nature or in practice would be like relative motion, a very smooth moving Tai Chi practitioner, because Tai Chi is very much about controlling your center of gravity and moving in a controlled manner through space with large ranges of motion. Mm-hmm. The opposite would be like a power lifter squatting 1,000 pounds. Correct. Where if I have to, I have this tremendous amount of force I have to be able to produce, I'm going to have to lock as many things together as possible to resist that load from driving me straight into the earth. Mm-hmm. Okay. We've talked
and
about
then,
like,
and then you have, even in that representation right there. So like the heavy squat representation, the perception is that all of that perceived joint motion is relative. And I would arguably disagree with that. You're certainly bending certain places that have a better option to bend than others do, right? You wouldn't want to bend in the middle of a femur because bad things happen under that circumstance. Yeah. You got a little bit of a softer area in the knee, but I got news for you. It's like, even if you took an x-ray and you go, look, the bones are in different places. It's like, yes, but you're bending connective tissue behaviors in that circumstance because the amount of force output that is crossing that joint, you are resisting movement. That's why the muscle is so active in that circumstance, which would stiffen those connective tissue behaviors. And then you're reducing the motor output just enough to allow those tissues to bend. And then you ramp the motor output back up, and then you try to make as much stiffness in those connective tissues as possible. And then that's what it looks like to stand up from a squat.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like bending. It's kind of like, a spring versus like bending a metal bar that just wants to kind of go back to its. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it is. It's a lot like that.
So we've talked about relative motions versus orientation. Now let's kind of talk about like what we've talked about, what it looks like when you don't have relative motion anymore through table measures, and what we would expect to see with like gait analysis, for instance. Now let's talk a little bit to wrap up here. Let's talk a little bit about what to do about if you've lost relative motion or you are orientating or you are orienting. Maybe first, actually, let's give a couple more examples of with complex movements and dynamic activities, what a loss of relative motion will look like. I have a few in my head. I don't know if you want to go first. Okay. So when, other than like the leaning and listening or the wobbling you might see in gait, you know, looking at where people, when they push into the ground with their hands or feet, where the weight is distributed. So if someone is away from midline, like they're doing a push up and they're pushing through the outsides of their hands, or if they're doing a squat and their heels are coming up and they're on the fifth metatarsal or on the outsides of their feet, I can tell that someone's putting force into the ground forward and outside of their base of support. Yes. So that would indicate to me that they are pushing into the ground with a lot of orientation.
Absolutely.
Versus someone that has like a heel contact in a squat is able to push through the middle of their foot and balance between the middle, outside, inside ball of the foot and the heel. Like that would be something that's closer, would allow for more relative motion.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Those because are my examples.
Because you're able to superimpose.
Sure.
So you're able to superimpose internal on external rotation. That is the expression of relative motion. So both have to be able to exist at the same time, which unfortunately it's taught that it's an either or scenario. You're either in external rotation or internal rotation, but that just has to do with an inadequate definition of those two concepts. External rotation is the space that allows you to acquire like a space that allows you to move anywhere, right? If I reach out, I have to have a space that I can actually reach into. If there's a wall there, I bump into the wall, no space, no ER, right?
Right.
IR is the amount of force that I can apply into the ground. So if I look at it from that perspective, I create a space to move into and I have to push into the ground. So both exist at the same time. And that's what relative motion is. So if I step forward, I land with my foot on the ground, I'm actually stepping into an ER space, and then I have to apply a force to the ground. The ground applies a force back up into me, and there's our IR representation. So I have both.
Yeah.
That's how it'd be.
And to be coherent with universal principles of physics, we're talking about potential energy and kinetic energy. So we're talking about creating.
Yes, certainly to a degree. Yes.
Right. We're creating space.
For those of you that are interested in Lagrangian physics, that's where that would be.
Yeah. So it's like the space that's created and the position, the starting position that allows for the movement through space.
Yes.
Which is coherent with this ER-IR representation, how both are existing at the same time and one superimposes over the other.
Yeah. It was just like we were talking about with the bone, with the bones yeah. moving relative to one another. It's like one, the perception is that one is moving in one direction and one is moving in the other. They could be moving in the same direction at different rates and still have the same perception.
Right.
But there, but again, there's still a superimposition there. And again, this is what allows us to dampen and absorb energy that we would use to move through space. So if we're walking, like we're absorbing energy on one end and we're propelling through space. By releasing that energy on the back end.
Sure. And when we're talking, like if I'm talking about elbow range of motion and extending and flexing, whatever the traditional representation of that is, in order to do that without a tremendous amount of resistance to motion, I need to have relative motions that cancel each other out to allow that action to happen. Like things are twisting and rotating and turning in order to allow that to happen. It is not a straight plane hinge.
No, these are turns. Everything that yes. you do, like all, when any muscle that is it, like the perception being shortening and lengthening, right?
Yeah.
Which is, it's a little less descriptive than it actually is. There is a twisting component to it that is taking place.
Right. And that's why I can do that funky hand trick where I bring my hand up, I rotate it, I go around and I don't move my hand, but by the end of it, I've moved my hand.
You're talking about the, what's his butt? Why am I drawing a blank on that?
I am too. That's why.
Oh my gosh. Why am I like, it's the triangle on the sphere. We're gonna come up with it. It's gonna have to be in the notes.
It's not a Buckminster Fuller thing, is it?
No, it's
anyways. No, okay, so here's your, if you're listening still in the comments, what's that thing that I'm talking about where you bend the arm and move it and then your hand position changes?
It's like this is age related decline because it's actually
very I mean, what's my excuse? I guess I have a child. I have a young child, so that makes gives me an excuse to have brain farts. Okay,
it's,
cool.
It's the paradox. It's the paradox.
Yeah. It's something paradox.
Shoot.
Post it in the comments. Okay. Anyways. Yeah. So it's, you don't need to post in the comments. I'm telling them to. Okay. So when we have
Codman's paradox. Measures,
what is it called?
Codman's paradox.
Okay. God. Gotcha.
Why is that so hard to remember?
I don't know.
My advanced age.
I couldn't remember it either. Yeah. So we've talked about like what loss of relative motion looks like, how we can measure it, how we can see it in dynamic movements. When we have someone that's lost relative motion and we're trying to regain relative motions and change their movement behavior to be something that's a little less interference for their symptoms and or their resistance to motion or range of motion, what do we do about it?
You mean to get it back?
Yeah, how do we get it back?
Okay. So here's one of your favorite principles of all time, right? It's like two steps forward, one step
forward.
Right. Yeah. So we're always going forward in every circumstance. We don't really have a backward. Okay. So all of our mechanical elements are to move forward. So here's the rules. We can move forward really fast. We can move forward slow, or we can actually stop. Okay. And then the ability for us to move forward slowly is actually where the greatest degree of relative motion would be represented. So most of the people that we'll see that have larger deficits in relative motion are high force producers or people moving very, very quickly, right? Because high force, we don't want relative motion. If I'm moving very, very quickly from a velocity standpoint, chances are I applied a high force just previously to that over a very short period of time, which allows the velocity to be demonstrated, which is demonstrated in external rotation without fail because IR is slow and high force, ER is fast. And so what we're actually teaching people to do is to continue to be able to move forward, but more slowly. And so in those circumstances, let me give you like the simplest way to slow someone down, lay them on their back, because all of their mass is behind what we would perceive as the ground contact, which would be your feet. Okay. That's actually moving forward slowly because of the way that we've reoriented gravity relative to our long axis allows us greatest degree of slowing down. Therefore, we have more access to relative motions under those circumstances. So this is typically why you may, in the initial phases of rehab, when you're working with somebody, use activities that are not upright or they're more reclined, because what, by changing the direction of gravity relative to the long axis, we can start to slow people down. So we will have greater access to the relative motions that we seek, because again, if that is representative of our greatest element of control, our ability to dissipate the energy that might be applying a much higher force, and therefore a symptom, that is going to be our targeted element. So step one is we got to slow people down in most cases. And that's going to be associated with any number of strategies. It's going to have an ER bias. It would be the ability to take a breath in without compensation, things like that. As you mentioned earlier, it's like the heel contact becomes very important, because if we don't have an adequate heel contact, we can never access the internal rotation that we need to slow down. So we actually use that in our favor to promote the yielding capabilities of connective tissue behaviors, the ability to absorb energy, and the ability to slow down. We're talking
about. We just did a couple episodes on shoes and feet where we actually talked about.
Just recently, the performance foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk about early to middle to late, and that delayed representation forward at a faster rate, full stop, full resistance to forward motion, all of that stuff. Watch those episodes if you want a second step to that, this conversation, like what else to do with it. If you are still watching this and you don't know about the UHP network, UHP.network, it's a place where we have a free course to learn Bill's model. And we talk a lot about a lot of this stuff and trying to put it into practice. So head over there. What can we ask people about? We've talked a bit about about music before, but mm-hmm. when you were a teenager, what was the music that you listened to that really like pissed off your parents, or they thought was like the devil's music? Or
okay, can I go with an alternative, but it's still on an album, but it wasn't music.
Okay.
I got a Richard Pryor album.
Okay.
Yeah. Dad didn't take to that too well because
Dad didn't like that.
I think I was like in the seventh grade. It's probably not where you want your son to learn those words.
Right.
Hilarious. Hilarious album. Arguably one of the greatest albums of all time. But when Dad heard that, he was like, I'm going to be taking that one away from you, son, kind of a thing. But the music, we hid the music in earphones, which is why I probably have like chronic tinnitus now, like a little too much Van Halen with the earphones on, like Van Halen 1. My dad was not a big Ted Nugent fan. I can definitely confirm that. So like anything that was guitar driven rock, like AC/DC, Van Halen, Ted Nugent. Yeah. Probably not my dad's favorite.
Yeah, I'd say like just the alternative rock days where it was like you listen to like Korn or like Limp Bizkit. I had albums from both of those.
Did
bands.
Not understand that music at all. That was
screaming rock music, new metal. I think it's called in some cases.
As soon as the flannel shirts started to show up, that like my music sort of cuts off.
Right. Well, that's like grunge. That was like Pearl Jam and Nirvana.
Yeah, I can't do that at all.
Right. I'm talking more about like rap, the alternative rock. It became like rap rock and new metal and stuff like that. Anyways, yeah, post in the comments if you're still listening. I'd love to hear what Dale probably listen to Elvis, and his parents didn't like that.
No, I bet Dale goes Led Zeppelin.
Okay. The parents were against Led Zeppelin?
His parents probably were. I mean, come on. Think about the music they grew up on.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, let's see, Dale's in Texas. So if he was still in Texas, you think like a Conway Twitty, Loretta Lynn, old school country music.
Anyways, and then, big and then shout out to Dale.
Led Zeppelin. And then Dale walks in with Zeppelin.
Hey, Dale, I know you're one of the first people to listen to this, so. How's it going?
Exactly. All
right. See you later.